He led Pris upstairs to his own apartment, dark and empty and stuffy and lukewarm as it was. Carrying her possessions into the bedroom, he at once turned on the heater, lights, and the TV to its sole channel.
"I like this,"
Pris said, but in the same detached and remote tone as before. She meandered about, hands thrust in her skirt pockets. On her face, a sour expression, almost righteous in the degree of its displeasure, appeared, in contrast to her stated reaction. "What's the matter?" he asked as he laid her possessions out on the couch.
"Nothing."
She halted at the picture window, drew the drapes back, and gazed morosely out.
"If you think they're looking for you," he began. "It's a dream," Pris said, "induced by drugs that Roy gave me."
Pardon?
"You really think that bounty hunters exist?"
"Mr. Batty said they killed your friends."
"Roy Batty is as crazy as I am," Pris said.
"Our trip was between a mental hospital on the East Coast and here. We're all schizophrenic, with defective emotional lives. Flattening of affect, it's called. And we have group hallucinations."
"I didn't think it was true," he said, full of relief.
"Why didn't you?" She swiveled to stare intently at him. Her scrutiny was so strict that he felt himself flushing.
Because things like that don't happen. The government never kills anyone for any crime. And mercerism...
But you see, Pris said, if you're not human, then it's all different.
That's not true. Even animals, even eels and gophers and snakes and spiders are sacred.
Pris, still regarding him fixedly, said,
so it can't be, can it?
As you say, even animals are protected by law. All life. Everything organic that wriggles or squirms or burrows or flies or swarms or lays eggs or... She broke off, because Roy Batty had appeared, abruptly throwing the door of the apartment open and entering. A trail of wire rustled after him. "Insects," he said, showing no embarrassment at overhearing them, "are especially sacrosanct." Lifting a picture from the wall of the living room, he attached a small electronic device to the nail, stepped back, viewed it, then replaced the picture.
Now, the alarm.
He gathered up the trailing wire, which led to a complex assembly. Smiling his discordant smile, he showed the assembly to Pris and John Isidore.
The alarm.
These wires go under the carpet. They're antennae. It picks up the presence of a... He hesitated.
A mentational entity, he said obscurely, which isn't one of us four.
So it rings, Pris said. And then what? He'll have a gun. We can't fall on him and bite him to death.
This assembly, Roy continued, has a Penfield unit built into it. When the alarm has been triggered, it radiates a mood of panic to the intruder. Unless he acts very fast, which he may. Enormous panic. I have the gain turned all the way up. No human being can remain in the vicinity more than a matter of seconds. That's the nature of panic. It leads to random circus motions, purposeless flights and muscle and neural spasms. He concluded, which will give us an opportunity to get him. Possibly. Depending on how good he is. Isidore said, won't the alarm affect us? That's right, Pris said to Roy Batty. It'll affect Isidore. Well, so what? Roy said, and resumed his task of installation. So they both go racing out of here, panic-stricken. It'll still give us time to react. And they won't kill Isidore. He's not on their list. That's why he's usable as a cover. Pris said brusquely, you can't do any better, Roy? No, he answered. I can't. I'll be able to get a weapon tomorrow, Isidore spoke up. You're sure Isidore's presence here won't set off the alarm? Pris said. After all, he's, you know. I've compensated for his cephalic emanations, Roy explained. Their sum won't trip anything. It'll take an additional human. Person. Scowling, he glanced at Isidore, aware of what he had said. You're androids, Isidore said. But he didn't care. It made no difference to him. I see why they want to kill you, he said. Actually, you're not alive. Everything made sense to him now. The bounty hunter, the killing of their friends, the trip to Earth, all these precautions. When I used the word human, Roy Batty said to Pris, I used the wrong word. That's right, Mr. Batty, Isidore said. But what does it matter to me? I mean, I'm a special. They don't treat me very well either. Like, for instance, I can't emigrate. He found himself yabbering away like a falsetto. You can't come here. I can't. He calmed himself. After a pause, Roy Batty said laconically, you wouldn't enjoy Mars. You're missing nothing. I wondered how long it would be, Pris said to Isidore, before you realized. We are different, aren't we? That's what probably tripped up Garland and Max Polakoff, Roy Batty said. They were so goddamn sure they could pass. Luba, too. You're intellectual, Isidore said. He felt excited again at having understood. Excitement and pride. You think abstractly, and you don't. He gesticulated, his words tangling up with one another. As usual. I wish I had an IQ like you have. Then I could pass the test. I wouldn't be a chicken head. I think you're very superior. I could learn a lot from you. After an interval, Roy Batty said, I'll finish wiring up the alarm. He resumed work. He doesn't understand yet, Pris said in a sharp, brittle, stentorian voice, how we got off Mars. What we did there. What we couldn't help doing, Roy Batty grunted. At the open door to the hall, Ermengarde Batty had been standing. They noticed her as she spoke up. I don't think we have to worry about Mr. Isidore, she said earnestly. She walked swiftly toward him, looked up into his face. They don't treat him very well either, as he said. And what we did on Mars, he isn't interested in. He knows us, and he likes us, and an emotional acceptance like that? It's everything to him. It's hard for us to grasp that, but it's true. To Isidore, she said, standing very close to him once again and peering up at him, "You could get a lot of money by turning us in. Do you realize that?" Twisting, she said to her husband, "See, he realizes that, but still he wouldn't say anything." "You're a great man, Isidore," Pris said. "You're a credit to your race."
"If he was an android," Roy said heartily, "he'd turn us in about 10 tomorrow morning. He'd take off for his job, and that would be it."
"I'm overwhelmed with admiration." His tone could not be deciphered. At least Isidore could not crack it.
"And we imagined this would be a friendless world, a planet of hostile faces all turned against us."
He barked out a laugh.
"I'm not at all worried," Irmgard said.
"You ought to be scared to the soles of your feet," Roy said.
"Let's vote," Pris said, "as we did on the ship when we had a disagreement."
"Well,"
Irmgard said, "I won't say anything more. But if we turn this down, I don't think we'll find any other human being who will take us in and help us. Mr. Isidore is..." She searched for the word.
"Special," Pris said.
Chapter 15. Solemnly and with ceremony, the vote was taken.
"We stay here," Irmgard said, with firmness. "In this apartment, in this building."
Roy Batty said, "I vote we kill Mr. Isidore and hide somewhere else." He and his wife, and John Isidore, now turned tautly toward Pris. In a low voice, Pris said,
"I vote we make our stand here."
She added more loudly, "I think JR's value to us outweighs his danger, that of his knowing. Obviously, we can't live among humans without being discovered. That's what killed Polakoff and Garland and Luba and Anders. That's what killed all of them."
"Maybe they did just what we're doing," Roy Batty said. "Confided in, trusted one given human being who they believed was different.
As you said, special." "We don't know that," Irmgard said. "That's only a conjecture. I think they,
she gestured,
"walked around, sang from a stage like Luba. We trust. I'll tell you what we trust that fouls us up, Roy. It's our goddamn superior intelligence."
She glared at her husband, her small, high breasts rising and falling rapidly.
"We're so smart. Roy, you're doing it right now. God damn you, you're doing it now."
Pris said,
"I think Irm's right."
"So we hang our lives on a substandard, blighted..." Roy began, then gave up.
"I'm tired," he said simply. "It's been a long trip, Isidore.
But not very long here,
unfortunately."
"I hope," Isidore said happily, "I can help make your stay here on Earth pleasant." He felt sure he could. It seemed to him a cinch, the culmination of his whole life, and of the new authority which he had manifested on the vidphone today at work. As soon as he officially quit work that evening, Rick Deckard flew across town to Animal Row. The several blocks of big-time animal dealers with their huge glass windows and lurid signs. The new and horribly unique depression which had floored him earlier in the day had not left. This, his activity here with animals and animal dealers, seemed the only weak spot in the shroud of depression, a flaw by which he might be able to grab it and exercise it. In the past, anyhow, the sight of animals, the scent of money deals with expensive stakes, had done much for him. Maybe it would accomplish as much now. "Yes, sir," a nattily dressed new animal salesman said to him chattily as he stood gaping with a sort of glazed, meek need at the displays. "See anything you like?" Rick said, "I see a lot I like. It's the cost that bothers me." "You tell us the deal you want to make," the salesman said. "What you want to take home with you and how you want to pay for it. We'll take the package to our sales manager and get his big okay." "I've got 3 thou cash." The department at the end of the day had paid him his bounty. "How much," he asked, "is that family of rabbits over there?"
"Sir, if you have a down payment of 3 thou, I can make you owner of something a lot better than a pair of rabbits." "What about a goat?"
"I haven't thought much about goats," Rick said.
"May I ask if this represents a new price bracket for you?"
"Well, I don't usually carry around 3 thou, Rick conceded.
"I thought as much, sir, when you mentioned rabbits. The thing about rabbits, sir, is that everybody has one. I'd like to see you step up to the goat class where I feel you belong. Frankly, you look more like a goat man to me."
"What are the advantages to goats?"
The animal salesman said, "The distinct advantage of a goat is that it can be taught to butt anyone who tries to steal it."
"Not if they shoot it with a hypno dart and descend by a rope ladder from a hovering hover car," Rick said. The salesman, undaunted, continued,
"A goat is loyal, and it has a free, natural soul which no cage can chain up. And there is one exceptional additional feature about goats, one which you may not be aware of. Oftentimes, when you invest in an animal and take it home, you find some morning that it's eaten something radioactive and died. A goat isn't bothered by contaminated quasi-foodstuffs. It can eat eclectically, even items that would fell a cow or a horse or most especially a cat. As a long-term investment, we feel that the goat, especially the female, offers unbeatable advantages to the serious animal owner."
"Is this goat a female?" He had noticed a big black goat standing squarely in the center of its cage. He moved that way, and the salesman accompanied him. The goat, it seemed to Rick, was beautiful.
"Yes, this goat is a female. A black Nubian goat, very large, as you can see. This is a superb contender in this year's market, sir, and we're offering her at an attractive, unusually low, low price."
Getting out his creased Sydneys, Rick looked up the listings on goats, black Nubian.
"Will this be a cash deal?" the salesman asked.
"Or are you trading in a used animal?"
"All cash," Rick said.
On a slip of paper, the salesman scribbled a price and then briefly, almost furtively, showed it to Rick.
"Too much," Rick said.
He took the slip of paper and wrote down a more modest figure.
"We couldn't let a goat go for that," the salesman protested.
He wrote another figure.
"This goat is less than a year old. She has a very long life expectancy.
He showed the figure to Rick. It's a deal, Rick said. He signed the time payment contract, paid over his $3,000, his entire bounty money as down payment, and shortly found himself standing by his hover car, rather dazed, as employees of the animal dealer loaded the crate of goat into the car.
I own an animal now, he said to himself. A living animal, not electric.
For the second time in my life. The expense, the contractual indebtedness appalled him. He found himself shaking.
But I had to do it, he said to himself.
The experience with Phil Resch. I have to get my confidence, my faith in myself and my abilities back, or I won't keep my job.
His hands numb, he guided the hover car up into the sky and headed for his apartment and Erin.
She'll be angry, he said to himself, because it'll worry her, the responsibility. And since she's home all day, a lot of the maintenance will fall to her.
Again, he felt dismal.
When he had landed on the roof of his building, he sat for a time, weaving together in his mind a story thick with verisimilitude.
My job requires it, he thought, scraping bottom.
Prestige. We couldn't go on with the electric sheep any longer. It sapped my morale.
Maybe I can tell her that, he decided.
Climbing from the car, he maneuvered the goat cage from the back seat, with wheezing effort, managed to set it down on the roof. The goat, which had slid about during the transfer, regarded him with bright-eyed perspicacity, but made no sound. He descended to his floor, followed a familiar path down the hall to his own door.
Hi, Erin greeted him, busy in the kitchen with dinner. Why so late tonight?
Come up to the roof, he said. I want to show you something.
You bought an animal.
She removed her apron, smoothed back her hair reflexively, and followed him out of the apartment. They progressed down the hall with huge, eager strides.
You shouldn't have gotten it without me, Erin gasped. I have a right to participate in the decision. The most important acquisition we'll ever...
I wanted it to be a surprise, he said.
You made some bounty money today, Erin said accusingly.
Rick said, Yes, I retired three Andes. He entered the elevator and together they moved nearer to God.
I had to buy this, he said.
Something went wrong today. Something about retiring them. It wouldn't have been possible for me to go on without getting an animal. The elevator had reached the roof. He led his wife out into the evening darkness, to the cage. Switching on the spotlights, maintained for the use of all building residents, he pointed to the goat, silently, waiting for her reaction.
Oh my God,
Erin said softly. She walked to the cage, peered in. Then she circled around it, viewing the goat from every angle.
Is it really real? She asked. It's not false?
Absolutely real, he said. Unless they swindled me. But that rarely happened. The fine for counterfeiting would be enormous. 2.5 times the full market value of the genuine animal. No, they didn't swindle me.
It's a goat, Erin said. A black Nubian goat.
Female, Rick said.
so maybe later on we can mate her. And we'll get milk out of which we can make cheese.
Can we let her out? Put her where the sheep is?
She ought to be tethered, he said, for a few days at least. Erin said in an odd little voice,
My life is love and pleasure. An old, old song by Josef Strauss. Remember? When we first met.
She put her hand gently on his shoulder, leaned toward him, and kissed him.
Much love. And very much pleasure.
Thanks, he said, and hugged her.
Let's run downstairs and give thanks to Mercer. Then we can come up here again and right away name her. She needs a name. And maybe you can find some rope to tether her.
She started off. Standing by his horse, Judy, grooming and currying her, their neighbor Bill Barber called to them,
Hey, that's a nice-looking goat you have, Deckards. Congratulations.
Evening, Mrs. Deckard.
Maybe you'll have kids. I'll maybe trade you my colt for a couple of kids.
Thanks, Rick said. He followed after Erin in the direction of the elevator. Does this cure your depression? He asked her.
It cures mine.
Erin said,
It certainly does cure my depression.
Now we can admit to everybody that the sheep's false.
No need to do that, he said cautiously.
But we can, Erin persisted. See, now we have nothing to hide. What we've always wanted has come true. It's a dream.
Once more she stood on tiptoe, leaning and nimbly kissing him. Her breath, eager and erratic, tickled his neck. She reached, then, to stab at the elevator button. Something warned him. Something made him say, Let's not go down to the apartment yet. Let's stay up here with the goat. Let's just sit and look at her and maybe feed the goat something. They gave me a bag of oats to start us out. And we can read the manual on goat maintenance. They included that, too, at no extra charge. We can call her Euphemia. The elevator, however, had come, and already Erin was trotting inside.
Erin, wait, he said.
It would be immoral not to fuse with Mercer in gratitude, Erin said. I had hold of the handles of the box today, and it overcame my depression a little. Just a little, not like this. But anyhow, I got hit by a rock. Here.
She held up her wrist. On it, he made out a small, dark bruise.
And I remember thinking, how much better we are. How much better off when we're with Mercer. Despite the pain. Physical pain, but spiritually together. I felt everyone else, all over the world, all who had fused at the same time.
She held the elevator door from sliding shut.
Get in, Rick. This'll be just for a moment. You hardly ever undergo fusion. I want you to transmit the mood you're in now to everyone else. You owe it to them. It would be immoral to keep it for ourselves.
She was, of course, right. So he entered the elevator and once again descended. In their living room, at the empathy box, Erin swiftly snapped the switch, her face animated with growing gladness. It lit her up like a rising new crescent of moon.
I want everyone to know, she told him. Once that happened to me, I fused and picked up someone who had just acquired an animal. And then one day,
her features momentarily darkened. The pleasure fled. One day I found myself receiving from someone whose animal had died. But others of us shared our different joys with them. I didn't have any, as you might know. And that cheered the person up. We might even reach a potential suicide. What we have, what we're feeling might...
They'll have our joy, Rick said. But we'll lose. We'll exchange what we feel for what they feel. Our joy will be lost. The screen of the empathy box now showed rushing streams of bright, formless color. Taking a breath, his wife hung on tightly to the two handles.
We won't really lose what we feel, not if we keep it clearly in mind. You never really have gotten the hang of fusion, have you, Rick?
Guess not, he said. But now he had begun to sense, for the first time, the value that people such as Erin obtained from mercerism. Possibly his experience with the bounty hunter Phil Resch had altered some minute synapses in him, had closed one neurological switch and opened another. And this, perhaps, had started a chain reaction.
Erin, he said urgently.
He drew her away from the empathy box.
Listen, I want to talk about what happened to me today.
He led her over to the couch, sat her down facing him. I met another bounty hunter, he said. One I never saw before. A predatory one who seemed to like to destroy them. For the first time after being with him, I looked at them differently. I mean, in my own way, I had been viewing them as he did.
Won't this wait? Erin said.
Rick said, I took a test, one question, and verified it. I've begun to empathize with androids, and look what that means. You said it this morning yourself. Those poor Andes. So you know what I'm talking about. That's why I bought the goat. I never felt like that before. Maybe it could be a depression like you get. I can understand now how you suffer when you're depressed. I always thought you liked it, and I thought you could have snapped yourself out any time. If not alone, then by means of the mood organ. But when you get that depressed, you don't care. Apathy. Because you've lost a sense of worth. It doesn't matter whether you feel better, because if you have no worth, what about your job? Her tone jabbed at him. He blinked.
Your job, Erin repeated. What are the monthly payments on the goat?
She held out her hand. Reflexively, he got out the contract which he had signed, passed it to her.
That much, she said in a thin voice. The interest. Good God. The interest alone. And you did this because you were depressed.
Not as a surprise for me, as you originally said. She handed the contract back to him.
Well, it doesn't matter. I'm still glad you got the goat. I love the goat. But it's such an economic burden.
She looked gray. Rick said, I can get switched to some other desk. The department does 10 or 11 separate jobs. Animal theft. I could transfer to that.
But the bounty money.
We need it or they'll repossess the goat. I'll get the contract extended from 36 months to 48. He whipped out a ballpoint pen, scribbled rapidly on the back of the contract. That way it'll be $52.50 less a month. The vidphone rang. If we hadn't come back down here, Rick said,
If we'd stayed up on the roof with the goat, we wouldn't have gotten this call.
Going to the vidphone, Erin said,
Why are you afraid? They're not repossessing the goat.
Not yet. She started to lift the receiver.
It's the department, he said. Say I'm not here.
He headed for the bedroom.
Hello, Erin said into the receiver.
Three more Andys, Rick thought to himself, that I should have followed up on today instead of coming home.
On the vid screen, Harry Bryant's face had formed, so it was too late to get away. He walked, with stiff leg muscles, back toward the phone.
Yes, he's here, Erin was saying. We bought a goat. Come over and see it, Mr. Bryant.
A pause as she listened, and then she held the receiver up to Rick.
He has something he wants to say to you, she said.
Going over to the empathy box, she quickly seated herself and once more gripped the twin handles. She became involved almost at once. Rick stood holding the phone receiver, conscious of her mental departure, conscious of his own aloneness.
Hello, he said into the receiver. We have a tail on two of the remaining androids, Harry Bryant said. He was calling from his office.
Rick saw the familiar desk, the litter of documents and papers and kipple.
Obviously, they've become alerted. They've left the address Dave gave you, and now they can be found at...
Wait. Bryant groped about on his desk, at last located the material he wanted. Automatically, Rick searched for his pen. He held the goat payment contract on his knee and prepared to write.
Conapt Building 3967C, Inspector Bryant said. Get over there as soon as you can. We have to assume they know about the ones you picked off, Garland and Luft and Polakoff. That's why they've taken unlawful flight.
Unlawful, Rick repeated. To save their lives.
Erin says you bought a goat, Bryant said.
Just today?
After you left work?
On my way home.
I'll come and look at your goat after you retire the remaining androids. By the way, I talked to Dave just now. I told him the trouble they gave you. He says congratulations and be more careful. He says the Nexus 6 types are smarter than he thought. In fact, he couldn't believe you got three in one day.
Three is enough, Rick said. I can't do anything more. I have to rest.
By tomorrow, they'll be gone, Inspector Bryant said. Out of our jurisdiction.
Not that soon. They'll still be around. Bryant said,
You get over there tonight, before they get dug in. They won't expect you to move in so fast.
Sure they will, Rick said. They'll be waiting for me.
Got the shakes?
Because of what, Polakoff? I haven't got the shakes, Rick said.
Then what's wrong?
Okay, Rick said. I'll get over there. He started to hang up the phone.
Let me know as soon as you get results. I'll be here in my office.
Rick said, If I get them, I'm going to buy a sheep.
You have a sheep. You've had one as long as I've known you.
It's electric, Rick said. He hung up. A real sheep this time, he said to himself. I have to get one. In compensation. At the black empathy box, his wife crouched, her face wrapped. He stood beside her for a time, his hand resting on her breast. He felt it rise and fall,
the life in her, the activity. Erin did not notice him. The experience with Mercer had, as always, become complete. On the screen, the faint, old, robed figure of Mercer toiled upward, and all at once a rock sailed past him. Watching, Rick thought, "My God, there's something worse about my situation than his. Mercer doesn't have to do anything alien to him. He suffers, but at least he isn't required to violate his own identity." Bending, he gently removed his wife's fingers from the twin handles. He then himself took her place, for the first time in weeks. An impulse. He hadn't planned it. All at once, it had happened. A landscape of weeds confronted him. A desolation. The air smelled of harsh blossoms. This was the desert, and there was no rain. A man stood before him, a sorrowful light in his weary, pain-drenched eyes. "Mercer," Rick said.
"I am your friend," the old man said. "But you must go on as if I did not exist. Can you understand that?"
He spread empty hands.
"No," Rick said.
"I can't understand that. I need help."
"How can I save you," the old man said, "if I can't save myself?"
He smiled.
"Don't you see? There is no salvation."
"Then what's this for?" Rick demanded. "What are you for?"
"To show you," Wilbur Mercer said, "that you aren't alone. I am here with you and always will be. Go and do your task, even though you know it's wrong."
"Why?" Rick said. "Why should I do it? I'll quit my job and emigrate." The old man said,
"You will be required to do wrong no matter where you go. It is the basic condition of life to be required to violate your own identity. At some time, every creature which lives must do so. It is the ultimate shadow, the defeat of creation. This is the curse at work, the curse that feeds on all life, everywhere in the universe."
"That's all you can tell me?" Rick said. A rock whizzed at him. He ducked, and the rock struck him on the ear. At once he let go of the handles, and again he stood in his own living room, beside his wife and the empathy box. His head ached wildly from the blow. Reaching, he found fresh blood collecting, spilling in huge, bright drops down the side of his face. Erin, with a handkerchief, patted his ear.
"I guess I'm glad you pried me loose. I really can't stand it being hit. Thanks for taking the rock in my place."
"I'm going," Rick said.
"The job?"
"Three jobs." He took the handkerchief from her and went to the hall door, still dizzy and now feeling nausea.
"Good luck," Erin said.
"I didn't get anything from holding on to those handles," Rick said. "Mercer talked to me, but it didn't help. He doesn't know any more than I do. He's just an old man climbing a hill to his death."
"Isn't that the revelation?"
Rick said, "I have that revelation already." He opened the hall door. "I'll see you later." Stepping out into the hall, he shut the door after him. Conapt 3967C, he reflected, reading it off the back of the contract. That's out in the suburbs. It's mostly abandoned there. A good place to hide. Except for the lights at night. That's what I'll be going by, he thought. The lights. Phototropic, like the death's head moth. And then after this, he thought, there won't be any more. I'll do something else. Earn my living another way. These three are the last. Mercer is right. I have to get this over with. But, he thought, I don't think I can. Two Andes together. This isn't a moral question, it's a practical question. I probably can't retire them, he realized. Even if I try. I'm too tired and too much has happened today. Maybe Mercer knew this, he reflected. Maybe he foresaw everything that will happen. But I know where I can get help. Offered to me before, but declined. He reached the roof and a moment later sat in the darkness of his hover car, dialing.
Rosen Association, the answering service girl said.
Rachel Rosen, he said.
Pardon, sir?
Rick grated, "Get me Rachel Rosen."
Is Miss Rosen expecting?
I'm sure she is, he said. He waited. 10 minutes later, Rachel Rosen's small, dark face appeared on the vidscreen.
Hello, Mr. Deckard.
Are you busy right now, or can I talk to you? He said. As you said earlier today. It did not seem like today. A generation had risen and declined since he had talked to her last, and all the weight, all the weariness of it had recapitulated itself in his body. He felt the physical burden. Perhaps, he thought, because of the rock. With the handkerchief, he dabbed at his still bleeding ear.
Your ear is cut, Rachel said. What a shame.
Rick said, Did you really think I wouldn't call you? As you said?
I told you, Rachel said, that without me, one of the Nexus Sixes would get you before you got it.
You were wrong.
But you are calling. Anyhow, do you want me to come down there to San Francisco?
Tonight, he said. Oh, it's too late.
I'll come tomorrow. It's an hour trip.
I have been told I have to get them tonight. He paused and then said, Out of the original eight, three are left.
You sound like you've had a just awful time.
If you don't fly down here tonight, he said, I'll go after them alone and I won't be able to retire them. I just bought a goat, he added, with the bounty money from the three I did get.
You humans.
Rachel laughed.
Goats smell terrible.
Only male goats. I read it in the book of instructions that came with it.
You really are tired, Rachel said. You look dazed. Are you sure you know what you're doing? Trying for three more Nexus Sixes the same day? No one has ever retired six androids in one day.
Franklin Powers, Rick said. About a year ago, in Chicago. He retired seven.
The obsolete Macmillan Y4 variety, Rachel said. This is something else.
She pondered.
Rick, I can't do it. I haven't even had dinner.
I need you, he said. Otherwise, I'm going to die, he said to himself. I know it. Mercer knew it. I think you know it too. And I'm wasting my time appealing to you, he reflected. An android can't be appealed to. There's nothing in there to reach. Rachel said, I'm sorry, Rick, but I can't do it tonight. It'll have to be tomorrow. Android vengeance, Rick said. What? Because I tripped you up on the Voight Kampf scale.
Do you think that?
Wide-eyed, she said.
Really?
Goodbye, he said, and started to hang up.
Listen, Rachel said rapidly. You're not using your head.
It seems that way to you because you Nexus 6 types are cleverer than humans.
No, I really don't understand, Rachel sighed. I can tell that you don't want to do this job tonight. Maybe not at all. Are you sure you want me to make it possible for you to retire the 3 remaining androids? Or do you want me to persuade you not to try?
Come down here, he said, and we'll rent a hotel room.
Why?
Something I heard today, he said hoarsely. About situations involving human men and android women. Come down here to San Francisco tonight and I'll give up on the remaining Andes. We'll do something else. She eyed him, then abruptly said,
Okay, I'll fly down. Where should I meet you?
At the St. Francis. It's the only halfway decent hotel still in operation in the Bay Area.
And you won't do anything until I get there.
I'll sit in the hotel room, he said, and watch Buster Friendly on TV. His guest for the last 3 days has been Amanda Verner. I like her. I could watch her the rest of my life. She has breasts that smile. He hung up then and sat for a time, his mind vacant. At last, the cold of the car roused him. He switched on the ignition key and a moment later headed in the direction of downtown San Francisco and the St. Francis Hotel.
Chapter 16. In the sumptuous and enormous hotel room, Rick Deckard sat reading the typed carbon sheets on the 2 androids, Roy and Irmgard Batty. In these 2 cases, telescopic snapshots had been included, fuzzy 3D color prints which he could barely make out. The woman, he decided, looks attractive. Roy Batty, however, is something different. Something worse. A pharmacist on Mars, he read. Or at least the android had made use of that cover. In actuality, it had probably been a manual laborer, a field hand with aspirations for something better. Do androids dream? Rick asked himself. Evidently. That's why they occasionally kill their employers and flee here. A better life, without servitude. Like Luba Luft. Singing Don Giovanni and Le Nozze instead of toiling across the face of a barren rock-strewn field on a fundamentally uninhabitable colony world. Roy Batty, the poop sheet informed him, has an aggressive, assertive air of ersatz authority. Given to mystical preoccupations, this android proposed the group escape attempt, underwriting it ideologically with a pretentious fiction as to the sacredness of so-called android life. In addition, this android stole and experimented with various mind-fusing drugs, claiming when caught that it hoped to promote in androids a group experience similar to that of mercerism, which, it pointed out, remains unavailable to androids. The account had a pathetic quality. A rough, cold android, hoping to undergo an experience from which, due to a deliberately built-in defect, it remained excluded. But he could not work up much concern for Roy Batty. He caught, from Dave's jottings, a repellent quality hanging about this particular android. Batty had tried to force the fusion experience into existence for itself. And then, when that fell through, it had engineered the killing of a variety of human beings, followed by the flight to Earth. And now, especially as of today, the chipping away of the original 8 androids until only the 3 remained. And they, the outstanding members of the illegal group, were also doomed, since if he failed to get them, someone else would. Time and tide, he thought. The cycle of life. Ending in this, the last twilight, before the silence of death. He perceived in this a micro-universe, complete. The door of the hotel room banged open.
What a flight,
Rachel Rosen said breathlessly, entering in a long fish-scale coat with matching bra and shorts. She carried, besides her big, ornate mail pouch purse, a paper bag.
This is a nice room.
She examined her wristwatch.
Less than an hour. I made good time. Here.
She held out the paper bag.
I bought a bottle. Bourbon.
Rick said, the worst of the 8 is still alive. The one who organized them. He held the poop sheet on Roy Batty toward her. Rachel set down the paper bag and accepted the carbon sheet.
You've located this one?
She asked after reading. I have a CONAPT number. Out in the suburbs where possibly a couple of deteriorated specials, antheads and chickenheads, hang out and go through their versions of living. Rachel held out her hand.
Let's see about the others.
Both females. He passed her the sheets, one dealing with Ermengarde Batty, the other an android calling itself Pris Stratton. Glancing at the final sheet, Rachel said,
Oh.
She tossed the sheets down, moved over to the window of the room to look out at downtown San Francisco.
I think you're going to get thrown by the last one.
Maybe not. Maybe you don't care.
She had turned pale and her voice shook. All at once, she had become exceptionally unsteady. Exactly what are you muttering about? He retrieved the sheets, studied them, wondering which part had upset Rachel.
Let's open the bourbon.
Rachel carried the paper bag into the bathroom, got 2 glasses, returned. She still seemed distracted and uncertain, and preoccupied. He sensed the rapid flight of her hidden thoughts. The transitions showed on her frowning, tense face.
Can you get this open? She asked. It's worth a fortune, you realize. It's not synthetic. It's from before the war, made from genuine mash.
Taking the bottle, he opened it, poured bourbon in the 2 tumblers. Tell me what's the matter, he said. Rachel said,
On the phone you told me if I flew down here tonight, you'd give up on the remaining 3 Andes. We'll do something else, you said. But here we are.
Tell me what upset you, he said. Facing him defiantly, Rachel said,
Tell me
what we're going to do instead of fussing and fretting around about those last three Nexus 6 Andes.
She unbuttoned her coat, carried it to the closet, and hung it up. This gave him his first chance to have a good long look at her. Rachel's proportions, he noticed once again, were odd. With her heavy mass of dark hair, her head seemed large, and because of her diminutive breasts, her body assumed a lank, almost childlike stance. But her great eyes, with their elaborate lashes, could only be those of a grown woman. There the resemblance to adolescence ended. Rachel rested very slightly on the forepart of her feet, and her arms, as they hung, bent at the joint. The stance, he reflected, of a wary hunter of perhaps the Cro-Magnon persuasion. The race of tall hunters, he said to himself. No excess flesh, a flat belly, small behind and smaller bosom. Rachel had been modeled on the Celtic type of build, anachronistic and attractive. Below the brief shorts, her legs, slender, had a neutral, non-sexual quality, not much rounded off in nubile curves. The total impression was good, however, although definitely that of a girl, not a woman, except for the restless, shrewd eyes. He sipped the bourbon. The power of it, the authoritative strong taste and scent, had become almost unfamiliar to him, and he had trouble swallowing. Rachel, in contrast, had no difficulty with hers. Seating herself on the bed, Rachel smoothed absently at the spread. Her expression had now become one of moodiness. He set his glass down on the bedside table and arranged himself beside her. Under his gross weight, the bed gave, and Rachel shifted her position. "What is it?" he said. Reaching, he took hold of her hand. It felt cold, bony, slightly moist. "What upset you?"
"That last goddamn Nexus 6 type," Rachel said, enunciating with effort, "is the same type as I am."
She stared down at the bedspread, found a thread, and began rolling it into a pellet.
"Didn't you notice the description? It's of me, too. She may wear her hair differently and dress differently. She may even have bought a wig. But when you see her, you'll know what I mean."
She laughed sardonically.
"It's a good thing the association admitted I'm an Andy. Otherwise, you'd probably have gone mad when you caught sight of Pris Stratton. Or thought she was me."
"Why does that bother you so much?"
"Hell, I'll be along when you retire her."
"Maybe not. Maybe I won't find her." Rachel said,
"I know Nexus 6 psychology. That's why I'm here. That's why I can help you. They're all holed up together, the last three of them, clustered around the deranged one calling himself Roy Batty. He'll be masterminding their crucial, all-out final defense."
Her lips twisted.
"Jesus," she said.
"Cheer up," he said. He cupped her sharp, small chin in the palm of his hand, lifted her head so that she had to face him. "I wonder what it's like to kiss an android," he said to himself. Leaning forward an inch, he kissed her dry lips. No reaction followed. Rachel remained impassive, as if unaffected. And yet he sensed otherwise. Or perhaps it was wishful thinking.
"I wish," Rachel said, "that I had known that before I came. I never would have flown down here."
I think you're asking too much. You know what I have? Toward this Pris android?
Empathy, he said.
Something like that. Identification. There goes I. My God, maybe that's what'll happen. In the confusion, you'll retire me, not her. And she can go back to Seattle and live my life. I never felt this way before. We are machines, stamped out like bottle caps. It's an illusion that I personally really exist. I'm just representative of a type. She shuddered.
He could not help being amused. Rachel had become so mawkishly morose. Ants don't feel like that, he said, and they're physically identical.
Ants. They don't feel, period.
Identical human twins. They don't.
But they identify with each other. I understand they have an empathic special bond.
Rising, she got to the bourbon bottle a little unsteadily. She refilled her glass and again drank swiftly. For a time, she slouched about the room, brows knitted darkly, and then, as if sliding his way by chance, she settled back onto the bed. She swung her legs up and stretched out, leaning against the fat pillows, and sighed.
Forget the three Andes.
Her voice filled with weariness.
I'm so worn out.
From the trip, I guess. And from all I learned today.
I just want to sleep.
She shut her eyes.
If I die, she murmured, maybe I'll be born again when the Rosen Association stamps out its next unit of my subtype.
She opened her eyes and glared at him ferociously.
Do you know, she said, why I really came here? Why Eldon and the other Rosens, the human ones, wanted me to go along with you?
To observe, he said. To detail exactly what the Nexus 6 does that gives it away on the Voight Kampf test.
On the test or otherwise. Everything that gives it a different quality. And then I report back, and the association makes modifications of its zygote bath DNS factors. And we then have the Nexus 7. And when that gets caught, we modify again, and eventually the association has a type that can't be distinguished.
Do you know of the Bonelli reflex arc test? He asked.
We're working on the spinal ganglia, too. Someday the Bonelli test will fade into yesterday's hoary shroud of spiritual oblivion.
She smiled innocuously, at variance with her words. At this point, he could not discern her degree of seriousness. A topic of world-shaking importance, yet dealt with facetiously. An android trait, possibly, he thought. No emotional awareness, no feeling sense of the actual meaning of what she said. Only the hollow, formal, intellectual definitions of the separate terms. And more. Rachel had begun to tease him. Imperceptibly, she had passed from lamenting her condition to taunting him about his.
Damn you, he said.
Rachel laughed.
I'm drunk. I can't go with you. If you leave here,
she gestured in dismissal.
I'll stay behind and sleep, and you can tell me later what happened.
Except, he said, there won't be a later. Because Roy Batty will nail me.
But I can't help you anyhow now because I'm drunk. Anyhow, you know the truth. The brick-hard, irregular, slithery surface of truth. I'm just an observer, and I won't intervene to save you. I don't care if Roy Batty nails you or not. I care whether I get nailed.
She opened her eyes, round and wide.
Christ, I'm empathic about myself. And see, if I go to that suburban, broken-down, Conapt building...
She reached out, toyed with a button of his shirt. In slow, facile twists, she began unbuttoning it.
I don't dare go, because androids have no loyalty to one another, and I know that that goddamn Pris Stratton will destroy me and occupy my place. See? Take off your coat.
Why?
So we can go to bed,
Rachel said. I bought a black Nubian goat, he said. I have to retire the three more Andes. I have to finish up my job and go home to my wife. He got up, walked around the bed to the bottle of bourbon. Standing there, he carefully poured himself a second drink. His hands, he observed, shook only very slightly, probably from fatigue. Both of us, he realized, are tired. Too tired to hunt down three Andes, with the worst of the eight calling the shots.